22-6077 U.S. v. Lester. Mr. Sandiford.
Yes, good morning. My name is Dean Sandiford from the Federal Defender's Office, and I'm here for Travis Lester. The main issue in this case is whether the district court plainly erred by failing to consider Section 5G1.3D of the sentencing guidelines in deciding whether to remove the consecutive sentence. Our position is that the court did plainly err and that the case should be remanded for resentencing. First, this court's precedent plainly required the district court to consider Section 5G1.3D, and it's plain on this record that the district court didn't do so. Defense counsel had requested a concurrent sentence, and 5G1.3D governed the decision on that point. But there was no mention of the guideline or the factors that the guideline required the district court to consider. And we know the district court didn't consider the guideline factors because it didn't have or refer to the information it needed to apply the factors.
You're claiming that because nobody mentioned what the state court sentence was, that the district court didn't know what it was?
No, that's not our claim. Our claim is that the district court failed to consider this guideline that the district court was required under this court's precedent to consider. The fact that this information that the guideline says to require wasn't at issue in the sentencing hearing, we cite as proof that the district court didn't consider the guideline. Because the district court couldn't have considered the guideline and the factors under the guideline without that information. So we cite that just for evidence. We're not faulting the district court, as the government says in its brief, for failing to ask questions about the state sentence. We're simply pointing to the fact that this material wasn't in the record and wasn't discussed at the sentencing hearing as proof that the guideline wasn't considered.
You're not arguing that the district court was necessarily required to cite the guideline specifically.
No, I don't think the district court was required to cite it specifically, but the court was required under cases like Hurley to consider the guideline and the accompanying commentary.
Well, there was discussion by the court about the defendant's criminal history, concern about danger to others. Why wouldn't that discussion be relevant to what the guideline calls for the court to consider?
Because what the guideline, it is relevant to what the guideline says to consider, because it says 3553A factors are one of the factors, but it also says the length of the state sentence, how long the defendant is likely to serve on the state sentence. That's the information that wasn't discussed. It was highly relevant to the decision whether to.
But we don't know that the district court didn't know that. Obviously, the defendant knew what it was. Government probably knew what it was. The district court knew that the sentencing was occurring, could have asked his clerk to check it.
That's certainly possible, but I don't think it's highly unlikely on this record because the length of the state sentence was long. It was a 10-year sentence. The guidelines say...
Well, that's true, but yeah. Wasn't it likely to be a 10-year sentence since it was a 10-year suspended sentence that got revoked?
No, because under Oklahoma law, when a judge revokes a suspended sentence, it can be in part. So there's no way to tell just by the initial amount of sentence that's imposed entirely suspended what the sentence is going to be imposed on revocation. It could be 1 year, it could be 6 months, it could be 10 years. There's no way to know. And I think that given the length of the sentence, had this been something the court was aware of, it naturally would have come up in the discussion because it's one of the factors that the guideline says is relevant and has to be considered.
But none of the defendants not raising it, so...
That's true, and that's why we're on plain error review. I don't think the defense counsel was aware of this guideline. If the defense counsel had been aware of this guideline, surely he would have cited it and made these arguments that we're making on appeal. Because he didn't do that, we're on plain error review, and we're stuck with plain error.
Are you so sure he would have cited it when there's commentary that seems to argue against your position?
Well, I'm assuming you're referring to the kind of recommendation in the guideline for a consecutive sentence in this circumstance.
Right.
That's only a recommendation. The guideline also says to consider these factors, and the factors were very helpful. The factors would have been very helpful if you had known about it. The length of the sentence, the time that he's likely to serve on it, these are things that might have been helpful to a request to run the sentence at least partially concurrent because the sentence was so long. This was a 10-year sentence in state court. He only ever served 3 years before, and here the federal judge is tacking on an additional 10. If the judge had known that this 10-year sentence was on top of an already imposed 10-year state sentence, it might have convinced the judge to impose at least a partially concurrent sentence in the federal case.
And there's nothing in the record, nothing in the PSR or any other document that would have informed the judge of the length of this state sentence?
No, because the PSR was done before the state sentencing. The state sentencing...
And there was nothing subsequent that...
Nothing subsequent that was filed. No, the only... At the sentencing hearing, the defense lawyer, who was also the defense lawyer in the state case, says he's already been sentenced in the state case. He goes off about how the judge wanted to go ahead and get the sentencing done, so we did it. But that's it. That's the only place where it's brought up. The sentencing happened about 3 weeks before, it sounds like, 3 to 4 weeks before the federal sentencing. So there's nothing in the record that would have told the district court either how long the state sentence was or how long he was likely to serve on it, which is another one of the factors, which, you know, in Oklahoma, they have a parole system, so that would require knowing parole eligibility date.
Can you draw any inferences from the fact that after defense counsel stated he was sentenced 2 weeks ago, can you draw any inference from the fact that the court didn't ask what the sentence was? Does that imply either that the judge knew or the judge knew that at most it would be 10 years, and if it was no more than 10 years, then he was going to tack it on?
I think what it suggests in the context of this record, where 5G1.3D doesn't come up at all, is that the judge didn't know it was a relevant consideration under the guideline. Because if the judge had been aware of the guideline...
Well, even if it's not relevant per se under the guidelines, it might be relevant to the judge in imposing sentence.
Sure, and I would have thought it would be relevant to the defense attorney too, and you know, it just didn't come up, and I don't know why. But you know, even if the judge somehow was aware of the sentence, and I don't think there's any evidence in the record that he was, there's other factors in this guideline, including when the defendant's likely to be released. None of that is easily ascertainable just from looking at the state docket. That's, you know, you would have to research the statutes, know what the parole eligibility date was, know how likely it is the defendant's likely to be paroled. Now, this is just something that would have to be based on experience in state court, which this defense lawyer had, and if he had been aware of the guidelines.
Counsel, there's a couple of parts of the Hurlett case I wanted to run by you on the plain error issue.
Sure.
One of them is... there, Hurlick said that the district court didn't need to make specific findings for the factors listed in the application notes. And, you know, you're referring to these factors, including the length of the state sentence, and of course the district court didn't speak to those factors. But even if that was error in this case, is it plain error in light of what was said in Hurlick?
So we're making two separate interrelated claims here. One is failure to consider the guideline, and one is failure to offer specific enough reasons. So the Hurlick stands for both propositions. Hurlick says you have to consider the factors, but then when you're explaining your sentence, the explanation doesn't have to track the factors. So what we're saying on the first point, that the judge didn't fail to consider the factors, the factors and the guideline, is that this guideline is nowhere in this case. Nobody talks about it. Nobody says anything that's relevant to the factors. And that's what we point to as proof that the judge didn't consider.
Well, I know you want to make both the failure to consider and failure to explain, but it seemed to me in light of this that maybe your failure to consider is your stronger argument. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that.
Okay. Yeah. Second thing is maybe this goes to failure to explain too, but in Hurlick, didn't we say that the reasons given for an upward departure were sufficient explanation for a consecutive sentence? And would that go to the plain error analysis?
I think on the failure to explain, it potentially would. Because if you accept the government's argument that the judge's explanation for his denial of the variance was also the reason for the consecutive sentence, that explanation was very similar to what this court said is okay in Hurley. Now we argue that it's plain on this record that the judge wasn't incorporating those reasons, but if you disagree with me on that, then I would concede that Hurley would control on that point, which is totally separate from the failure to consider it.
I got one more. It's a little different from what I've been asking you, but I can't help but think that this argument you're making sounds a little bit more like an ineffective assistance of counsel argument, in the sense that Mr. Lester's attorney should have made the court aware of the state sentence. Isn't this more appropriate for a 2255 motion?
Well, I think the same is true in a lot of plein air cases. I mean, in pretty much any plein air case, you're going to have the defense lawyer missing an obvious issue. So there's obviously overlap between these two doctrines. If a lawyer misses an obvious issue that's an error that's prejudicial, that would make a good IAC claim, but it also makes a good plein air claim. So there's overlap there, but it's not as if the existence of a possible IAC claim means that a plein air review claim isn't appropriate.
One doesn't exclude the other. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yes. Unless the court has further questions, I'll be able to remain there.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Stephen Craig on behalf of the United States. The district court properly imposed Mr. Lester's federal sentence consecutively with the state revocation sentence. I actually want to start where counsel and Judge Matheson left off, because every aspect, and the reason I want to start there, is every aspect of Mr. Lester's argument as to why this constitutes plain error points back not to something the district court was required to do, some obligation of the district court, but because the district court allegedly couldn't comply with what was required because counsel didn't provide that information. This quite simply reads like a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Why was there error? Does Mr. Lester claim that the district court shouldn't consider 521.3b? Because counsel didn't present information. Why is it plain? Because the district court didn't have information because counsel didn't present. Why is there harm? Mr. Lester claims that there's harm because if the defense counsel had presented the information, the sentence would be different. This is quite clearly a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. There might be a reason why counsel didn't present this information. Mr. Lester argues that 10 years might have influenced the district court to say, oh, I don't want to impose this much more punishment. But he also could have not provided it because this shows how seriously the state court viewed the infraction.
But if the guidelines say the court must consider these factors, and you have defense counsel saying my client was sentenced 2 weeks ago, and aspects of that sentence are among the factors that must be considered, then didn't the district court have to consider the factors by just asking someone who clearly has the information? How do you get around the fact that the court was supposed to consider something and didn't, even though perhaps the defense counsel hadn't volunteered the information, but the information was readily available to the court?
Well, so there are a couple of different ways. Let me start broadly by saying Application Note 4A says that these are factors the court should consider, but Application Note 4A covers a broad plethora of cases. The more specific guideline that governs here is Application Note 4C. And here, in this instance, the commission specifically provided that it recommended the sentence be imposed consecutively to the revocation sentence. And with regard to what was argued just a moment ago.
You think that note overrides, essentially says the other factors don't matter if the sentence was imposed with respect to a violation of probation or supervised release?
Yeah, I'm saying the factors could be considered, and those were factors to be considered, but the commission in promulgating, and all of this falls under 51.3b, which is a policy statement. So none of this was binding even before Booker. It's definitely not binding now.
But what do you mean by not binding?
So it was always persuasive. It was always 51.3b, unlike 5G1.3a, B, or C, which were guidelines, was specifically designated by the Commission as a policy statement.
I thought, don't we have some Tenth Circuit authority that says that the commentary is binding, generally?
Commentary to guidelines is binding to the extent that it's inconsistent. My point here is that unlike a normal guideline, say, unlike a Chapter 2 guideline, or even unlike 5G1.3a, B, or C, this was specifically designated as a policy statement to give the district court flexibility. The only reason I point this out is not to say the district court shouldn't consider it. I'm not saying the district court shouldn't consider application of 4A. But one of the counsel's arguments was, well, 4C is just a recommendation. Well, 5G1.3a, or excuse me, 5G1.3b was never a binding guideline to the extent that it was not designated as a guideline.
Well, so the district court needed to decide whether the 120-month sentence would run consecutively or concurrently. Are we okay so far?
Well, I would argue that at least Congress has suggested that's not the case because under 18 U.S.C. 3584A, Congress provided a benchmark for if the court simply doesn't address it, and it says, absent being ordered by the court, it is to run consecutively.
All right.
But accepting that the court has to address it because...
I guess where I'm going with this is... it seems to me highly relevant in making that determination for the court to consider what the state sentence was. I mean, if it was 6 months, that's one thing. But here it's 10 years. So we're talking about 10 years on top of 10 years. And where is there any indication in the record that there was any meaningful consideration of what it meant to run a consecutive sentence? I mean, it just strikes me that if this went back to the district judge, and everyone is fully informed of the 10-year state sentence, are we really going to get another 120 months on top of that?
You're right about that, Judge Matheson. I think that it is quite possible. One, because as the district court...
Well, even if it's possible, how can we say that the court gave any meaningful consideration to that question? And there's nothing in the record to show that he was aware of the 10-year state sentence.
Your Honor, reversing on plain error in this case based on that reasoning is to impose upon the district court the obligation to go out and do fact-finding.
Well, the provision says that. He's supposed to consider the time served on the undischarged sentence and the time likely to be served before release. I mean, we wouldn't be imposing that obligation. This provision in the commentary imposes that obligation.
So, first of all, assuming the commentary, the application of 4C, can be ignored because you're saying we have to look at 4A to provide the government commentary where 4C is the specific situation. The question still comes down to how does the district court get this information? And the way at least...
Well, he asked for it. He says, how long is the sentence? How long is the state court sentence? How hard is that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I would suggest that Mr. Lester, just this morning, explicitly waived that the district court was under any claim that the district court was obligated to ask any question. But if this is the case, then you're imposing upon the district court the obligation to do defense counsel's job for him.
Well, if this had happened 6 months earlier, he had been revoked and sentenced to the 10 years 6 months earlier, wouldn't the probation office have an obligation to include that in the PSR? Wouldn't that be absolutely part of the PSR?
I think it would generally be included.
Okay. So information that needs to be included in the PSR doesn't need to be included if the information arises between the time of the PSR and the sentencing hearing? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the obligation to present evidence for a district court to apply the law to is the obligation of counsel, not the obligation of the court. So, for example, say there was some mitigating piece of evidence that the defense counsel knew, or some piece of evidence that was relevant to the 3553A fact. Can the defense counsel, or on appeal, on direct appeal, come up and say, the district court did not consider the 3553A factors because counsel knew this fact, but didn't present it to the district court? I would suggest that if this court holds that, and that's what this court would at least be suggesting in this case.
Now, why would that be so in the face of the guideline commentary? I mean, the court wouldn't be saying anything that, the holding wouldn't be anything that the district court didn't know or should have known has to come from the defendant. That is way overbroad. What we're really talking about here is a guideline commentary that says you need to know what the undischarged sentence is. And maybe defense counsel should have said something, but is that the end of the matter?
Well, Your Honor, so in talking about plain error, the sole case, or the main case that Mr. Lester relies upon is Hurlick. And Hurlick doesn't discuss the length of the sentence. Hurlick doesn't discuss anything about the underlying sentence. Hurlick looks at, and honestly, the district court in Hurlick simply cited, I believe, three of the 3553A factors. It didn't say anything about the specifics of the case.
And well, so, okay, so you've moved to, I understand you're arguing about plain error, but do we have error then?
I would submit no, we don't, because I would submit that the guideline itself, 5G1.3D, says the court can impose a sentence term consecutively, concurrently, or partially consecutively to further the goals of sentence, or to the extent necessary for it to achieve just sentence, or something along those lines. And the district court, explaining the sentence that imposed, denying the variance, explained that it was cognizant of the requirement, and that it weighed heavily on its decision to impose such a sentence. Now, to use the parsimony principle from 3553A, but the parsimony principle from 3553A and what the guideline itself says are equivalent. They're essentially functionally, I would say, the same thing. And so when you then get into the application notes, and this is something that Mr. Lester runs away from time and time again, doesn't mention, gives one passing reference, I think, in his reply brief, is application note 4C, which sets out the specifics. And so was the district court aware? The district court could have been aware of application note 4C that says, we recommend that you impose the sentence consecutive. And this court has said in cases like Benally, that there is no need for magic words or ritualistic incantations. The court doesn't have to say 5G1.3. I think Hurlick probably, and Judge Matheson, you described it as part of this, said the court isn't required to make specific findings for the factors listed in the application notes.
Well, and I think Mr. Sanford explained that. That may relate to his failure to explain argument, but doesn't necessarily address the failure to consider. And I'm looking at a recent case, U.S. v. Babcock, decided last year, where we cite the Supreme Court and quote the Supreme Court, saying that commentary in the guidelines manual that interprets or explains a guideline is authoritative, unless it violates the Constitution or a federal statute or is inconsistent with or plainly erroneous reading of that guideline. So why wouldn't that impose an obligation at least to consider what the underlying state sentence was on the district judge?
And if the district court had the information, this might be a chicken and egg approach, but you ask what requires, or what doesn't require the district court to consider that information, if I understood the question correctly. And part of that, in this case, is the fact that the defendant simply didn't provide that information. And so the question really then comes down to, is the district court required to sua sponte go out and get that information on its own?
Yeah. Well, I see your chicken and egg point, but, you know, I guess I'm still fixed on the word consider. How can there be consideration when you don't have what you need to have consideration.
Well, yeah. So I think if I can circle back to what the question you asked before that, because I have a second part that might help inform. And that's, this court shouldn't elevate the general application note 4A above the more specific application note 4C. And so if in considering this, and if in considering the authoritative application notes to the guidelines, this court should start with the more specific and say, there's a presumption that the court should impose a sentence consecutively. Now, defendant, here are ways to argue that the court shouldn't apply such a consecutive sentence. It should apply either a concurrent sentence or a partially concurrent sentence. And just to finish up with that, as this court interpreted 71.3F in United States v. Ursinos Sotelo, it's the defendant's burden. Can I finish my...
Thank you.
It's the defendant's burden to come forward with a reason upon which the district court should exercise its discretion to impose concurrent sentences, not consecutive sentences, not the district court's obligation to explain why just generally it's imposed a consecutive sentence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You had 4 minutes or something like that, didn't you? 4 minutes and a second.
4 minutes and a second, okay. I really just want to make one point about this specific guideline controlling over the general thing. That's not this situation here. The guideline, application note, I mean, with the factors in it, says it applies to 5G 1.3D across the board. Those factors have to be considered in any 5G 1.3D case. The guideline that the government is pointing to does have a recommendation, even under the guidelines, it's a recommendation of a consecutive sentence in this situation, but it's only a recommendation. And by providing these factors for courts to consider in every 5G 1.3 case, the commission's acknowledging that not in every case that's not going to be the appropriate sentence. And if you look at the factors themselves, they strongly point towards at least partially concurrent sentence here. So I think this recommendation that the government points to really is more a third prong than anything else. The court had to consider the factors in the earlier application note. The recommendation is certainly relevant at third prong, but it's not enough to overcome the reasonable probability that the judge may have imposed at least a partially concurrent sentence because the factors pointed towards that, namely the length of the sentence and how long it was.
Did you agree that this is a policy statement rather than a guideline?
I would have to look. It wouldn't surprise me if it is, but I don't know the answer to that for sure. I don't think it matters because this court has said in Herlick and in Moyer that the district court has to consider these factors. And not considering the factors is a form of procedural reasonableness. You know, I know that the Chapter 7 policy statements, the ones that are kind of, there's some overlap there. That entire chapter is policy statements. I don't want to, you know, just guess, and I don't know exactly what the answer is. But again, I don't think it matters one way or another because there's two published decisions from this court saying you have to consider these factors if 5G 1.3D applies. And that's the question for your questions.
Thank you. Case is submitted.